The next case is 03-1447, Alan Payne versus Progressive Preferred Insurance Company. Mr. Oki.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Stephen Oki, representing the plaintiff appellant, Alan Lane. Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to address appellant's propositions of law 1 and 2 and cede the balance of my time to my co-counsel, Kevin Green, to address the class action aspects of this appeal. Okay.
He'll need to do that in a way that the appellees have a chance to to rebut that argument. So he needs to make his argument before rebuttal.
That was our plan, Your Honor.
Okay, all right.
Thank you. Members of the court, the Hartman versus Duffy case, as a bottom line, was about whether the interest statute, Revised Code 1343-03A, had any real meaning. And that opinion stated emphatically that it did. This case, Lane versus Progressive, is about whether Hartman itself, after only 2 years, has any real meaning, or whether the statutory obligation to pay interest can easily be circumvented. We ask that this court reaffirm Hartman emphatically and let insurance companies and settling parties throughout this state know that the statute and Hartman mean exactly what they say. And they say, in summary, that a settling creditor has an obligation to pay interest from the date of settlement, that the interest accrues from the date of settlement.
Does that break down day by day or hour by hour, in your view?
Your Honor, I believe that it would be broken down on a per diem basis.
Per diem?
Yes, sir.
So there's a 24-hour grace period, in your view?
I don't know if I would describe it as a grace period, Justice O'Donnell, but...
Well, if the settlement occurred in Toledo and the lawyer got back to his office in Columbus, it took 3 hours, and sent out a settlement check, would there be 3 hours worth of interest due if the settlement occurred at noon and the check left there at 3 o'clock?
I think if somebody was to take that position, it would be viewed as an extreme position, Your Honor, because settlement interest is...
So 3 hours is okay.
Interest
is a week reasonable?
It's not the issue, Your Honor, is not whether a week or a day is reasonable, but is it in compliance with the statute, and has the interest obligation been triggered by the date of settlement? And it is our position that it has been triggered.
Why would a settlement not include the release and all the documents? Because I have seen many settlements fall apart at the release stage because a certain party doesn't agree on the release, and therefore there really is no meeting of the minds and the settlement falls apart. Why is it not included at the release stage that signing of the release then triggers the actual payment?
Your Honor, the release can, if the parties so intend and so draft the release, to include the matter of interest. In this particular case, it's not included. The release is completely silent as to the issue of interest.
No, it doesn't matter that the release is silent as to the issue of interest. And as you know, I dissented at Hartman, so you don't probably have a sympathetic voice here. But the issue of signing a release can be, you know, I don't agree to this term, I don't agree to that term, and all of a sudden you say, well, I'm not paying you the money if you don't sign the release, and then there's no settlement. The release, to me, is an integral part of the settlement, so that at least if you follow Hartman, why isn't the signing of the release the final act of completion of the settlement?
Because the oral agreement, the settlement agreement that is reached, and in Hart case that was on the first day of trial, that is a fully enforceable contract. That oral agreement is an enforceable contract, enforceable by both the insurer as well as by the claimant.
Is it enforceable if your client says, okay, I'm not going to sign a release though, but pay me the check?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because under the Spursel case of this court saying that an oral settlement agreement is enforceable by the parties. It is enforceable. Our point, Your Honor, is that...
Have you ever seen a settlement check paid without a release? Have you ever seen a court enforce a PI settlement case without your client being willing to sign a release?
I think not, Your Honor, and I think that I've also never seen an insurance company send a settlement check if there hasn't been an oral settlement agreement that's fully enforceable. Our point is that the settlement, as Justice Sweeney stated in the Hartman case, at the point of settlement, the settlement debt is created, and the settlement interest obligation is triggered at that moment. Not the date the release is signed, unless the parties have specifically and expressly so stated in the release, which leads to the second point. And that second point is that the Court of Appeals below has misapplied the parole evidence rule to use it not as a shield to protect the writing from contradictory terms that would seek to vary the substance of the release, but the Court of Appeals, as it did in the Gulmish case, misapplied the parole evidence rule, and now it is being used in this case not as a shield of the writing, but as a sword to strike down matters that are silent in the release and that are not contradictory in the release. When the parole evidence rule is misapplied in that manner, then you have an absurd situation where an oral settlement agreement is certainly legitimate for purposes of enforceability, but has no meaning whatsoever for purposes of the statutory obligation that is owed to the debtor, owed by the debtor, excuse me, to the settlement creditor. Justice Moyer, Chief Justice Moyer, stated in the Judy versus BMV case, and it's quite emphatic that the right to statutory interest is automatic as a matter of law. And if Hartman and the statute can be very conveniently circumvented, as the Court of Appeals and the insurance company would do in this case, then it has turned both the statute and the Hartman case on its head.
How many days of interest are you suggesting are owed in this case, Mr. Oki?
Your Honor, the date of the settlement was, I believe, October 31st.
Yes.
And the check was sent on
November 7th.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes. So 7 days, is that was your position?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Okay, so your view is once the check is sent, the obligation for interest is terminated.
That is our position, Justice, because at that moment it has left the control of the insurance company. It's no longer within their custody.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to cede the balance of the appellant's time to my co-counsel on the class action issue.
Thank you, Mr. Oki. Mr. Green.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Kevin Green, also for Mr. Lane. On the class issue, quite simply, there has to be a class action here because without it, all the class members, all the persons who are entitled to interest automatically under the statute are not going to get it back. They practically otherwise do not have a remedy. And in fact, when we parse the trial court's rationale, it's apparent that a class action is mandated under this court's precedents. Now, it helps at the outset to refocus on what is this case about? And particularly when you're talking about class certification, you have to focus on the relevant facts. Mr. Lane has blonde hair. Other class members may have brown hair or red hair, but those are not relevant facts. What are the relevant facts? This case is about interest owed under a statute based on a simple calculation.
If a release has been signed and a party has waived any and all rights and a check has been endorsed or negotiated, is there a waiver issue here?
That issue was decided in Snyder, where the court held that it could not be waived. It was the intermediate court, the 8th District, and then this court affirming the award of interest and that decision. And what we're talking about on waiver is, can you waive something that is incorporated automatically into the settlement agreement at the time of settlement? Can you waive it later by a general release? And the answer is no. That's Snyder. Now, that doesn't mean, now Progressive has said that, well, that means that we're taking the extreme position that you can never negotiate it. And in fact, Hartman says you can. You can negotiate a payment date, but that didn't happen in this case. So there is a way to do it, but it wasn't done here. Now, on class certification, the trial court gave three reasons for finding that a class action was not warranted under the predominance prong of Rule 23b3. It said that each class member has unique damages with unique facts and unique witnesses. Now, unique damages, disparate damages for each person in a class action is almost always a given. Decades of case law from this court, and this is virtually a uniform rule around the country, have said that that is not a basis for denying class certification. And notably, Progressive does not defend that part of the ruling in its brief. Now, unique facts is really a restatement of unique damages, because what facts are we talking about? We're talking about the facts that go to the interest calculation. It's really about damages. It's about what each person is owed under the statute. And unique facts runs squarely into this court's latest decision on Rule 23, Consolidated Mortgage, where this court said that if differing facts for each person were always a basis for denying certification, it would always be denied. But the point here is that you have a unifying question of law, a violation of the statute, just as you had it consolidated. You have the same thing here. And just so my position is clear, if you were to ask me what is my best case, it's Consolidated Mortgage. Now, the third factor, the third underpinning of the trial court's rationale was unique witnesses. And what this really gets to is not what do you have to prove to prevail on your claim, but how are you going to do it? And is a class action going to be manageable? And we know in this case it's entirely manageable. You can do this entirely from Progressive's own records. Mr. Lane's claim shows that. And Consolidated Mortgage tells us that when it is possible to prove your case class-wide based on generalized evidence, as the terminology goes, you can have a class action. And there's been no convincing rebuttal to that here. So what we have is a very simple calculation for each person owed interest automatically under the statute as a matter of law that they cannot retrieve otherwise without a class action, and it can be done based on the defendant's business records. That's why class action is mandated here. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Gargo.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Ernie Vargo. I represent the Appalachian Progressive Preferred Insurance Company. The appellant would have this court believe that the Fifth District opinion overruled this court's decision in Hartman. Nothing could be further from the truth. The sole issue here is what was the settlement agreement date. That issue was not before the court in Hartman. The agreement date was given. It was agreed to in Hartman. As a result, in Hartman, the court saw no argument about an integration clause. This court has long upheld the integrity and validity of integration clauses, even in the context of settlement agreements. It would be astray from this court's longstanding precedent to disregard this very clear integration clause in the November 15 document that the appellant signed. Similarly, there was no argument in Hartman about a release. The parties in Hartman had expressly carved out the issue of interest from the terms of the release, unlike the clear and very broad release language in the November 15 document here. Next, there was no argument about res judicata in Hartman. As the court knows, the issue of interest was brought to this court before the underlying trial court issued a judgment in Hartman. That was the whole issue in Hartman, whether interest would run from the date of the judgment or from the date of the agreement. Here, the appellant received his settlement check, $12,500. There was no interest included, none should have been. He held that check for 3 weeks before the court dismissed the case with prejudice. Under the longstanding precedent in Ohio, that claim, any claim for prejudgment interest, was merged into the final judgment and forever extinguished in the November 27 judgment issued by the trial court.
But that's really not what Hartman says, is it?
Hartman says
that the entitlement, whether it be pre-judgment, post-judgment, or post-settlement, is allowed not only to account for the loss, but to support the individual from being deprived of the use of his money and gained by the debtor.
That is correct, Justice.
The claim is that your company has 7 days' worth of interest on the $12,500. That's what they're looking for.
That is correct. We, of course, dispute that, but keep in mind—
You didn't have the use of the $12,500 for 7 days?
We had the use of $12,500 for 7 days from October 31 until November 7th.
Right.
We also had no benefit of a release during that time. We had no assurance this deal would not fall through. We had no freedom from the underlying litigation for those 7 days, for it was not dismissed with prejudice until November 27th. We had no settlement agreement until November 15th.
What did you have on October 31st?
We had an understanding with plaintiff's counsel on October 31 that we could reach an agreement to settle this case for the amount of $12,500. Nobody will ever argue that amount is not a very important element of a settlement, but it clearly is not the only element. It is not the only term. The issue of release is very critical to a payor. In this case, we issued the check. After October 31, the appellant further bargained the terms of this settlement by crossing out the terms of the indemnity provision that was set forth in the November 15th document. With, presumably upon the advice of counsel, the appellant took the November 15th document that he ultimately signed, that he reserved, that he received with the check, and crossed out the indemnity language. Now, Progressive had to determine at that point, once it was signed and returned, whether that was acceptable to it. It did. On November 15th, when Progressive had the release, had accepted the fact that there would be no indemnity, and had the agreement that the case would ultimately be dismissed, it had an agreement in November. It had an agreement on November 15th. Now, the finality of the decision has to mean something. This court said in Lovewell, the issue of prejudgment interest is qualitatively different from post-judgment interest.
But had you given him the check on the 31st and gotten a release signed, there would be no problem.
There would be no problem. But that is an extraordinary burden to have put on counsel who has no agreement going into the October 31 pretrial.
What burden would you have?
The burden would be counsel does not know the case that they will reach agreement on the amount at the pretrial. They bargain. There are probably numbers kicked around back and forth. They finally conclude.
Are you going to pay more than $12,500?
No, we would have loved to pay less, Justice.
So you had an agreement on the 31st that they would accept $12,500, and the release could have been signed right there. No problem. Why the delay of weeks and months down the line before you send a check, you getting the use of the money every day? Why don't you have your adjusters or lawyers come with a check, come with a release, get it over with on the same day?
Justice, I can only point to the burdens on counsel that that would require. Counsel doesn't know that one term of the agreement of the settlement will be reached at that time. They bargain over the amount. When they come to terms on one issue, one term, amount.
You've had discussions with the opposing counsel on other occasions before this settlement date, have you not?
Counsel frequently has settlement discussions.
Sure you do.
And settlements occur at various times.
You know whether or not this case is going to settle before it even settles. You know that if the damages in the case are $15,000 and you've got a $12,500 policy, you know you can settle that case for $12,500 anytime. Right?
I would respectfully disagree. Counsel has certain authorization as to
who
what to settle.
The delay in the receipt of the check?
I am glad you asked that question. The facts of this case, this is not an example, Justice Sweeney, of an abusive insurance company. The insurance company's lawyer met at a pretrial with plaintiff's counsel, came to an agreement on one term of a settlement, thereafter went to his office, drafted up a draft document, and within seven days, that check was sent.
Is the settlement check ever given on the date the settlement is received?
I don't recall a single settlement that I've ever been involved in where we reach terms on the amount over the phone.
Well, it's never done.
It's never done.
Right.
Correct.
So you can settle a case on Monday and send the check a week later or 2 weeks later, whenever you feel that the time is, and all the matters that you want settled are settled, and get to use that money for that time.
The presumption of the question is that you have a settlement agreement that day. Here, we only came to terms on one material term of the settlement, not the others. If the plaintiff, if there's too much of a delay, Justice.
Why didn't you get all the other issues settled on that date?
Because as is custom, the agreement needed to be in writing. Progressive would never settle a case like this without a written release.
Counselor, couldn't it also have been argued or agreed to on that date at the pretrial conference that the plaintiff would have said, the agreement is contingent on me having a check negotiable in 3 days? Could have been understood between the parties, but it wasn't. And there was no indication to you, I'm presuming, or the counsel at the time, that they expected a check before a release.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. There was never a suggestion by them when they received the $12,500 that where is the interest? They received the check. Only after they received the check did they sign the release, releasing us from any claims.
With modifications to the release?
With modification, Justice.
So the sands were still shifting until you received that release back and acquiesced to it?
That is correct, Justice. And in fact, in the November 15 agreement, they expressly agreed that there was no prior agreement, whether it be October 31 or any other date.
But and the problem that I see with this, if we rule in your favor, there is nothing to keep an insurance company from delaying sending a check. If we don't go by the oral date, there's no reason that insurance companies wait a week, a month. I mean, this is a short period of time we're talking about, and we're talking about a small amount of interest. But this could have been a much larger sum, and 7 days would have meant something. But what would keep an insurance company from not sending the check for a month?
Two reasons, the very two that were an issue in Hartman. You would not, the plaintiff would refuse to sign a release. And number two, the plaintiff would refuse to dismiss the case, to stipulate to the dismissal. You would have no settlement. That's what keeps the defendant to the amount.
But still, the plaintiff is the one that's settling, is suffering if they were to refuse the settlement. So it still falls upon the insurance company to send the check in a timely way or to pay interest from the date of the oral agreement.
Correct, Justice. In Hartman, unlike here, what did the plaintiff do? He moved the court. He got his $1 million settlement and said, where's my interest? The defendant said, you're not entitled to any. There was no judgment, no dismissal, no settlement in writing. The plaintiff in Hartman moved the court timely and said, I'm owed interest on this. The appellant here never moved the court and said, I'm owed interest. He waited a year and a half later to file a subsequent action. But if the plaintiff says, okay, at the pretrial, as is custom, the plaintiff could have said, I need that check in 7 days. Is that okay, defendant? Defendant says yes. That's an oral due and payable clause. What this court says is perfectly appropriate, and what appellant accepts is appropriate. If the defendant says, I have a big client, I need to talk to two people, this is a big amount, can I have 30 days to get you that check? And if the plaintiff agrees, that's an oral due and payable clause, where interest does not begin to run from the date they agree on the amount. If it's unacceptable, as is custom, as happens all the time, the plaintiff says, no, I need that check in 2 weeks. Defendant says, I can't do it. Plaintiff says, then you owe me interest. No, I won't owe you interest. We don't have a settlement. We will not release you, and we will not dismiss this litigation. Let's go back to the bargaining table.
Counsel. Was the case settled on October 31st?
The settlement agreement was reached on November 15th, Justice. They argue that the settlement agreement was reached on October 31.
There were notes in the adjuster's file that said settle this case on the 31st of October.
That is precisely correct.
Was he lying?
No, he wasn't. He was speaking in his belief that the case is settled and the settlement will be effectuated. He used the same language all of us use when we trust that we will be able to iron out the other important terms of the settlement.
Why did he say it was settled on the 31st when in his mind it wouldn't?
No, he wasn't making a legal conclusion as to whether there was a binding agreement.
He was making a factual statement.
He was making a factual.
The case was settled in his mind on the 31st.
In his mind, he would not see the case again after October 31st. You are correct.
He's out of his way. He doesn't have to look at it again.
That is correct. And
goes on to another case.
That is correct, Justice.
Well, then why isn't it settled on the 31st?
He relied on his effective counsel to get that deal done, and his counsel did.
When do you say it's settled?
November 15th. We take the plain language of the November 15th document, Justice Sweeney, that says there was no prior oral settlement agreement.
So you don't believe your own employee who says that the settlement on the 31st, you want to have a date that you want to pick for being settled?
No, Your Honor. We believe that employee. We believe custom and practice. And we believe our lawyer is going to get that deal done. Our lawyer had to give up the indemnity clause to get it done. He would never have given up the release clause to get it done. Never. We would have never had a settlement agreement.
Counsel, your time's almost up. I'd like to hear you tell us why these cases, if there's a class action, how it differs from consolidated mortgage. Because it seems to me that isn't very much like consolidated mortgage.
Thank you, Justice. The appellant defines his class to exclude individuals who had an oral due and payable clause. This court in Hartman expressed the significance of an oral due and payable clause. There is nothing in Progressive's records, or even in the record of this case, that says what was orally agreed to on October 31 regarding timing of payment. Now, we know lawyers every day, when they settle an amount for $10,000, say, can I get you that check in a week? How's 2 weeks? Is that okay? If the plaintiff's attorney agrees, that is an oral due and payable clause. The trial court would need to take evidence from those lawyers or from those parties to determine whether there was an oral due and payable agreement between those lawyers in order to do two things. One is identify class members, and two, to determine liability. And that is the requirement of individualized evidence that distinguishes it from consolidated mortgage, and clearly shows that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying class certification.
So you would distinguish it. First we have to follow your other argument and buy into that, and if we do, that distinguishes it. If we don't, then aren't you right in the jaws of consolidated mortgage?
Justice, no. You cannot. It would be perfectly consistent not to buy our first argument, but to say we understand the significance of an oral due and payable clause. The court wrote about it in Hartman. Appellant defines his class as such. Even if there is a finding that interest is owed, in order to determine whether interest is owed to the tens of thousands of class members, the court would still need to find out if those two attorneys or two parties agreed orally as to when the check could be sent, okay. In which case that's an oral due and payable clause. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Vargo. Mr. Oakey, you've saved a little more than 3 minutes of your time. Okay.
Just briefly, Your Honors. Well, our position is not that the insurer necessarily has to write a check on the date the claim settles, but if they delay before they pay, they have to pay interest. That's the statute, and that's Hartman. And as the court's questions indicate, that's the only way to ensure that the settling plaintiff is fully compensated.
Do you think this case was settled on October 31st?
Yes.
Why was the case not dismissed on October 31st then, if it was settled? Why wouldn't they have just gone, why wouldn't the lawyers have gone in to the clerk or to the judge and said, we'd like to sign a dismissal entry, this case is over? If it was in fact settled, why did that not occur?
Well, the dismissal is an act effectuating the October 31st agreement.
Say that again?
The dismissal affects the October 31st agreement,
well,
brings it into effect. I mean,
if I understand your argument, you said the case was settled between the lawyers on October 31st, correct?
Correct.
Okay, but then the lawyers left the courthouse and the case was still pending at that point. Am I right?
The underlying action is still pending, but the dismissal...
Well, I don't mean the underlying action. There was a case filed by the plaintiff this here, correct?
Correct.
That case, when the lawyers left the courtroom on October 31st, was still pending in the active docket of the court, correct?
Correct.
Well, if the case was settled, why didn't the lawyers dismiss it? Why didn't they sign a stipulation for a dismissal and end it?
Because the October 31st agreement was an executory contract. That is to say, the party's obligations still remain to be performed. There was an enforceable contract, but Mr. Lane's consideration was releasing his claims and implicitly dismissing the case.
So each party needed to do something further before the case, before the contract could be completed?
Actually, no. Our position is that there was a contract on October 31st.
I thought you said there was an executory contract and the parties needed to do additional things in order to get the contract completed.
Well, by an executory contract, I mean that the parties still must perform their respective obligations, but a contract already exists, so it's not inconsistent.
Okay.
So the issuance of a check and the return of a release are part of the actions to be executed in order to put that contract to bed, so to speak, and then the dismissal being filed with the court.
Those are acts that implement the agreement that was reached on October 31st.
Okay, right. And what about the modification of the indemnity portion of the release that was sent and with the check? How do you view that?
Indemnity is not an essential term of the contract. I'm glad you asked that because that was one point I was going to get to. At pages 7 and 8 of our reply brief, I mean, we briefed all this, that indemnity is not an essential term. A release is not an essential term. If the parties enter into a settlement
agreement. Wait, back up. You think a release is not an essential portion of this contractual arrangement?
No. And we have cited cases in our reply brief. I think Spurcell and Mack in particular, this court's decisions, address this, where...
Didn't your co-counsel say that he's never seen a check issued without a release?
I don't know that he meant to suggest that a release is necessarily essential in every case. In Spurcell and Mack, you had a plaintiff who agreed to settle and then refused to sign a release. It's one of the two cases, maybe both. And the holding is that the court can, or the opinion says, that the court can craft the release if necessary.
The court can craft, but there's still a release.
The court can craft it if the parties are unable to agree. It does not mean that there is no agreement, in this case, on October 31st. That is our position.
But you said before that a release is not essential, and in the case that you just mentioned, apparently it was essential enough for the court to craft a release and bind the parties to it.
Well, it doesn't mean if the parties agree to it and yet they're unable to agree on the language, the court can craft the language. It doesn't mean that you don't have a contract earlier.
But you do go into the preliminary steps of attempting to agree on the language of the release, which is what was done here with the modification of the release in the indemnity section, and then the return of that to the insurance company for their review.
Well, that's correct. The indemnity provision was crossed out, but if Progressive was not okay with the adjustment to the release, that doesn't mean there wasn't a contract on October 31st. And we've addressed this in our reply brief at pages 7 and 8. My time has almost expired. Just quickly.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.